I want to tell you about a brand new cruise ship as part of the Norwegian Cruise Line, known as the Norwegian Escape. Norwegian Escape is a relatively large cruise liner, 4,200 passengers. But within the ship, there is another ship, a ship within a ship, or a subdivision known as the Haven. And if you're fortunate enough to hold a gold key card, which means you have access to the Haven, you're a passenger aboard the elite section of the cruise ship, it means you have access to a limited and exclusive section equipped with a concierge service, a 24-hour butler service, a private pool, a sun deck, a restaurant just for you, free from the crowds found elsewhere on the ship. Should the Haven guests venture out from their little oasis into a show or a public component of the cruise ship, all they have to do is merely flash their gold card, and they're given the best seats in the house. And naturally, every time the ship ports, docks itself, they disembark before everyone else, and they board the ship yet again before everyone else. And truth is, this sort of exclusive treatment, the separation of classes, is nothing new. It was true aboard the infamous Titanic, and remains a factor aboard every single airplane, in amusement parks, at theaters, sporting events. What is, however, new, and the companies are starting to do, is they're starting to become more adept in identifying their top customers and knowing the psychological buttons to push. In other words, the companies know that if you can make something exclusive, you can make something a little more reserved, where someone of a lower class can't achieve that level, you make that section more desirable. Privileges for the very rich, while not a new issue, is now something being exploited specifically for the sake of making people jealous, of creating a velvet rope and creating a preferred side of the aisle and a regular side. And it's that element that I think our Parsha gives voice to. Our Parsha opens up with a familiar duality of halacha. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe b'har Sinai le'mor. God spoke to Moshe on Har Sinai, saying, Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'marta lehem. Speak to the Yisrael, say to them, Ki tavo la'aretz asher ani noseh lachem. When you come to the land that I'm giving you, v'shav ta'aretz Shabbos la'Hashem. Chazal famously asked, Ma inyan Shemitah etzel Har Sinai? Why is the topic of Shemitah, the resting of the land after every 7 years cycle, why is that found next to the topic of Har Sinai? There are a number of possibilities suggested in the Mefarshim. One approach is that Har Sinai is the single most unifying event in our people's history. Ki'ish echad belev echad. Matan Torah is an event for all to experience. It's focused on the universal guidelines impacting all of mankind for all of history. And Shemitah, however, is the exact opposite. It is a set of laws pertaining to landowners, to the elite, to the creme de la creme, to the people who have the wherewithal to afford property. The Shemitah cycle affects the land, it affects the entire market, and surely impacts the bottom line for all. But at its core, it is most deeply concerned with the aristocracy, with the high society, with the wealthy. And so perhaps what was bothering the sages of Ma Inyan Shemitah Etzel Har Sinai was, how do you move from the universalism, from the universal nature of the Hamon Am, as described in the Matan Torah experience, in the Har Sinai experience, to the very particular, detailed, specialized, and unique arena of Shemitah? From the laws which affect everyone, from man, woman, and children, to those which concern themselves just with the a la carte population of Klal Yisrael, the landowners. And brings us to a separate question. What is the goal of Shemitah? Why did God ordain the land, an inanimate object, to be required a period of rest? Why does property have to rest? Why did the land need to stop being worked at some point in its cycle? And the Kli Yakar, on the one hand, focuses on the fact that it's part of the necessary environmental upkeep of the land, that a land that is constantly being worked will be depleted of its raw materials, and it's not optimal for growth and for produce and for the long-term picture of the health of the land. That's one approach in the Kli Yakar. But there is another approach that emerges in the Kli Yakar in his commentary by the Mitzvah of Hakel in Sefer Devarim. He suggests that the year of Shemitah, Gorem Gam Ha'akel Ve'ashalom Ayyidei Shelo Yizro V'lo Yatzmiach Po V'achlu Avyonei Amo Imo, that that what is special about the Shemitah cycle is that it allows the people who are poor to be kindred spirits with the wealthy landowners. That if you are a landowner during that Shemitah year, you're not allowed to profit from your land anymore. That normally machlokas, arguments, jealousy is the product of I have more than the other person, that I'm on the preferred side of the stadium, that I have the special, unique section of the cruise ship of the Norwegian cruise line, and that you don't. But that elitism, which is only by virtue of the fact that I am better than the other person, is done away with during the Shemitah year. During the Shemitah year, when the wealthy landowners, the exclusive, particular class that belongs in the first section, the business class, the first class, during that year, they are not able to profit. Instead, are forced by the rules of nature and halacha to share their wealth with the people who don't have the privilege to own land. The institution of smicha is more than just the socialist construct. It's more than just giving to people who don't have. But rather, it's about saying that the success of another person should not come on the backs of someone who does not experience that success. The Rambam Art of Buchim explains that the purpose behind Shemitah is lechemla al b'nei Adam, so that we learn to show mercy and compassion for other people. And we find ourselves driven by desire for success, for material wealth. But the Torah doesn't want that success to be defined as having things that others don't have. Even in the hallowed confines of a synagogue, we experience joy sometimes through relative success of our counterparts. There are premium seats. You can buy a special section. You can buy your name. You can buy certain rights in Jewish institutions. And they're necessary motivating factors. But at the core, there's something nefarious. There's a little voice which calls out saying, I'm better than you. Because if I didn't believe I was better than you, I wouldn't have the motivation necessary to do the good deeds that I'm doing. And perhaps Shemitah is calling us to inculcate in our own philosophy that our success is not by dint of someone else's relative lack of success. That my sense of self-esteem and self-worth must not be established on the back of someone else who can't achieve that. And so here's the question. Do we want to be part of a type of community, a type of people that expects people who are not of the same economic class to do more menial hands-on labor and allows others to opt out of indignity via donation or via class? I always ask, is a task like setting up a shalashuris, is that beneath a person's kavod, if they're of a certain economic class? Now, by the way, this doesn't work in the corporate world. You need people to be driven by relative success. One-upsmanship is part of the necessary drive to succeed as an organization, and it's part of human nature. But the Torah reminds us once every 50 years to embrace the supernatural, to journey beyond the way of Teva, Lamala Mena Teva, Veshovta Haaretz, and allow the land to rest. It's a designation which elevates those by dint, not of class segregation, not by the fact that there's someone who's an untermensch, someone who's an ubermensch, someone who's on a higher level and someone who's on a lower level, but the fact that we have chemla, that we have mercy, compassion, that we feel unified with those around us. The temporary relinquishing of ownership of the land enables the Ani to experience freedom from the dark burden of subordination and inferiority. I want to share with you a story that was circulating on the internet a few years ago. Rabbi Elazar Gilzaler was a Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Or Yisrael, and he was tragically killed at a young age as a bus that he was riding crashed near Meron in Eretz Yisrael. Now, a few years later, his daughter was driving in the Garden State Parkway in the States, and she stopped for gas and noticed that the attendant had dwarfism. He was a dwarf, and he began to wash the windows, doing his job, and he caught sight of a large picture on the passenger's seat, which was actually a picture of her father, Rav Elazar Gilzhaler. And he became very excited, and he started to point out the rabbi, and he says to the woman, "How do you know that man?" She said, this is my father. "I've been looking for him for 2 years," the gas station attendant said. "Where is he?" And the girl gently informed him that the man in the portrait had passed away from injuries sustained during a bus accident. And the fellow stared at her for the longest time, disbelief in his eyes, and he began to cry silently. "You know," he said, "I do this job day after day, morning after freezing morning. There are not many jobs available for someone like me. Cars pull up here every few moments, but everyone averts their eyes, their feeling of discomfort as they stare at my strange appearance. And then one day, your father pulled in. He looked me straight in the eye and he said, like no one else had ever done before, 'My friend, you are an inspiration. You were born with what might appear to be a great handicap, but you refuse to play the role of victim. You get up in the morning, you go to work, you earn an honest living. You're a role model. You teach that circumstances do not dictate the terms of a person's existence.' That's an inspiration." And then your father told me something that I'll never forget. He said, "I'm on the way to New York, and I have a large school, and I'm going to tell my students all about you so that they'll learn from your example." With his eyes glistening, the gas station attendant completed his tale. He said, "Of course. I had so looked forward to seeing your father again, for he was the only person in my life to make me feel tall." Ma'in Shmita Etzel Har Sinai. Perhaps it's the fact that Shmita is the great equalizer. Shmita restores for us, at least for a period of time, to the ideals of Har Sinai, of Ke'ish Echad B'Lev Echad. That Shmita, the very exclusive institution of the landowners, of the wealthy, can be just like the Sinai experience in which everybody is there, Ke'ish Echad B'Lev Echad. At Sinai, our pursuits of success do not depend upon someone standing on the other side of a velvet rope. At Sinai, it doesn't make a difference who's next to you. And just for a brief, shining moment, Shmita is Eitzel Har Sinai. Shmita brings everyone back to that experience in which even the lowly gas station attendant can feel tall, can feel like a mensch yet again.